Rule 4. Notice that opportunity lurks where responsibility has been abdicated. Make yourself invaluable. In my dual role as clinical psychologist and professor, I have coached many people in the development of their careers. Sometimes those I am coaching consult me because their coworkers, subordinates, or bosses will not do their jobs properly. They are supervised by, working alongside, or managing people who are narcissistic, incompetent, malevolent, or tyrannical. Such things happen and must be dealt with in whatever reasonable manner will bring them to a halt. I do not encourage people to martyr themselves. It is a bad idea to sacrifice yourself uncomplainingly so that someone else can take the credit. Nonetheless, under such circumstances, if you are a wise and attentive person, you might still notice that your unproductive co-workers are leaving a plethora of valuable tasks undone. You might then ask yourself, what would happen if I took responsibility for doing them? It is a daunting question. What is left undone is often risky, difficult, and necessary. But that also means, does it not, that it is worthwhile and significant? And you may have the eyes to see that there is a problem, despite your all-too-frequent blindness. How do you know that it is not, therefore, your problem? Why do you notice this issue and not some other? This is a question worth considering in depth. If you want to become invaluable in a workplace, in any community, just do the useful things no one else is doing. Arrive earlier and leave later than your compatriots. But do not deny yourself your life. Organize what you can see is dangerously disorganized. Work when you are working, instead of looking like you are working. And finally, learn more about the business or your competitors than you already know. Doing so will make you invaluable, a veritable linchpin. People will notice that and begin to appreciate your hard-earned merits. You might object, "Well, I just could not manage to take on something that important." What if you began to build yourself into a person who could? You could start by trying to solve a small problem, something that is bothering you that you think you could fix. You could start by confronting a dragon of just the size that you are likely to defeat. A tiny serpent might not have had the time to hoard a lot of gold, but there might still be some treasure to be won, along with a reasonable probability of succeeding in such a quest and not too much chance of a fiery or toothsome death. Under reasonable circumstances, picking up the excess responsibility is an opportunity to become truly invaluable. And then, if you want to negotiate for a raise, or more autonomy, or more free time, for that matter, you can go to your boss and say, "Here are 10 things that were crying out to be done, each of them vital, and I am now doing all of them. If you help me out a bit, I will continue. I might even improve, and everything, including your life, will improve along with me." And then, if your boss has any sense, and sometimes bosses do, then your negotiation will be successful. That is how such things work. And do not forget that there is no shortage of genuinely good people who are thrilled if they can give someone useful and trustworthy a hand up. It is one of the truly altruistic pleasures of life, and its depth is not to be underestimated or to be disregarded with the cheap cynicism that masks itself as world-weary wisdom. It appears that the meaning that most effectively sustains life is to be found in the adoption of responsibility. When people look back on what they have accomplished, they think, if they are fortunate, "Well, I did that, and it was valuable. It was not easy, but it was worth it." It is a strange and paradoxical fact that there is a reciprocal relationship between the worth of something and the difficulty of accomplishing it. Imagine the following conversation. Do you want difficulty? "No, I want ease." In your experience, has doing something easy been worthwhile? "Well, no, not very often." "Then perhaps you really want something difficult." I think that is the secret to the reason for being itself. Difficult is necessary. It is for this reason that we voluntarily and happily place limitations on ourselves. Every time we play a game, for example, we accept a set of arbitrary restrictions. We narrow and limit ourselves and explore the possibilities thereby revealed. That is what makes the game, but it does not work without the arbitrary rules. You take them on voluntarily, absurdly, as in chess. I can only move this knight in an L. How ridiculous! But how fun! Because it is not fun, oddly enough, if you can move any piece anywhere. It is not a game anymore if you can make any old move at all. Accept some limitations, however, and the game begins. Accept them, more broadly speaking, as a necessary part of being and a desirable part of life. Assume you can transcend them by accepting them. And then you can play the limited game properly. And this is all not merely of psychological import. And it is by no means just a game. People need meaning, but problems also need solving. It is very salutary from the psychological perspective to find something of significance, something worth sacrificing for or to, something worth confronting and taking on. But the suffering and malevolence that characterize life are real, with the terrible consequences of the real, and our ability to solve problems by confronting them and taking them on is also real. By taking responsibility, we can find a meaningful path, improve our personal lot psychologically, and make what is intolerably wrong genuinely better. Thus, we can have our cake and eat it, too. Responsibility and meaning. The idea that life is suffering is a relatively universal truism of religious thinking. This is the first of the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism, as well as a key Hindu concept. There is a tradition that the ancient Indian word for suffering, dukkha, from the Pali language, or dukkha, from Sanskrit, is derived from dus, bad, and ka, hole, particularly the hole in a horse-drawn cartwheel through which the axle passes. The proper place for such a hole is dead center, right on target. The ride is likely to be very bumpy otherwise, with the bumps directly proportional in magnitude to the degree of offset. This is quite reminiscent, to me, of the Greek term hamartia, which is frequently translated as sin in the context of Christian thought. Hamartia was originally an archery term, and it meant to miss the mark or target. There are many ways that a target can be missed. Frequently, in my clinical practice, and in my personal life, I observed that people did not get what they needed, or, equally importantly, perhaps, what they wanted, because they never made it clear to themselves or others what that was. It is impossible to hit a target, after all, unless you aim at it. In keeping with this, people are more commonly upset by what they did not even try to do than by the errors they actively committed while engaging with the world. At least, if you misstep while doing something, you can learn from doing it wrong. But to remain passive in the face of life, even if you excuse your inaction as a means of avoiding error, that is a major mistake. As the great blues musician Tom Waits insists in his song A Little Rain, you must risk something that matters. This is the colossal blunder made, for example, by the fictional Peter Pan. Pan, a name echoing the Greek god of the wilds, means encompassing everything. Peter Pan, the magical boy, is capable of everything. He is potential itself, like every child, and that makes him magical, in the same way that every child is magical. But time whittles that magic away, transforming the fascinating potentiality of childhood into the oft apparently more mundane but genuine actuality of adulthood. The trick, so to speak, is to trade that early possibility for something meaningful, productive, long-term, and sustainable. Peter Pan refuses to do so. This is at least in part because his major role model is Captain Hook. Captain Hook is the archetypal tyrannical king, the pathology of order, a parasite and a tyrant, terrified of death. He has his reasons. Death stalks Hook in the form of a crocodile with a clock in his stomach. That is time. Tick-tock, tick-tock. That is life vanishing as the seconds march by. The crocodile has had a taste of Hook, too, and liked it. That is life as well. It is not only cowards who are terrified by what lurks down in the chaotic depths. It is a rare person who has not suffered through disappointment, disease, and the death of a loved one by the time childhood ends. Such experiences can leave those who have had them bitter, resentful, predatory, and tyrannical, just like Hook. With a role model like the captain, it is no wonder Peter Pan does not want to grow up. Better to remain lost in fantasy with Tinkerbell, who provides everything a female partner can provide, except that she does not exist. Wendy, the great love of Pan's life, chooses to grow up despite her admiration for her friend Peter. She takes a husband, facing, even welcoming, her maturation and its lurking hints of mortality and death. She consciously chooses to sacrifice her childhood for the realities of adulthood, but gains real life in return. Peter remains a child, magical to be sure, but still a child, and life, limited, finite, and unique, passes him by. In the J.M. Barrie play, Peter Pan or the Boy Who Would Not Grow Up, Pan is portrayed as unafraid of death, which he faces on Marooner's Rock. His attitude might be misunderstood by inattentive viewers as courage. After all, Pan says, "To die will be an awfully big adventure." But the psychologically insightful unseen narrator objects, "To live would be an awfully big adventure." Truly a statement about what might have happened had the boy king chosen Wendy, noting immediately afterward, "But he can never quite get the hang of it." Pan's hypothetical lack of fear of death is not courage, but the manifestation of his basically suicidal nature, the sickness of life, which he is constantly manifesting by his very refusal to mature. It is by no means a good thing to be the oldest person at the frat party. It is desperation masquerading as cool rebelliousness, and there's a touchy despondence and arrogance that goes along with it. It smacks of Neverland. In the same manner, the attractive potential of a directionless but talented 25-year-old starts to look hopeless and pathetic at 30 and downright past its expiration date at 40. You must sacrifice something of your manifold potential in exchange for something real in life. Aim at something. Discipline yourself, or suffer the consequence. And what is that consequence? All the suffering of life, with none of the meaning. Is there a better description of hell? Life is dukkha for the Buddhists, equally, perhaps, although less explicitly, for the Hindus. The Hebrew scriptures, for their part, chronicle the history of the suffering of the Jewish people, individually and as a nation, although the triumphs are not ignored. Even those who are called on by Yahweh himself to move into the adventure of life by no means escape catastrophe. Perhaps Abraham, the archetypal patriarch, had an intuition of this. He was clearly something of a Peter Pan himself. The biblical account insists that Abraham stayed safely ensconced within his father's tent until he was 75 years old, a late start, even by today's standards. Then, called by God, inspired by the voice within, let us say, to leave family and country, he journeys forward into life. And what does he encounter after heeding the divine call to adventure? First, famine, then tyranny in Egypt, the potential loss of his beautiful wife to more powerful men, exile from his adopted country, conflicts over territory with his kinsmen, war and the kidnapping of his nephew, extended childlessness despite God's promise to make him the progenitor of a great nation, and, finally, terrible conflict between his spouses. The Abrahamic story made a great impact on me when I began to study and appreciate it more deeply. It has at its core a strange combination of pessimism and realistic, genuine encouragement. The pessimism? Even if you are called by God himself to venture out into the world, as Abraham was, life is going to be exceptionally difficult. Even under the best of all conceivable circumstances, almost insuperable obstacles will emerge and obstruct your path. The encouragement? You will have the opportunity to reveal yourself as much stronger and more competent than you might imagine. There is a potential within you, some of that magic so evident in childhood, that will emerge when circumstances demand and transform you, God willing, into someone who can prevail. There is a very old idea, which I have only recently come to comprehend, at least in part. It is something you see manifested in many literary, imagistic, and dramatic forms, ancient and modern. It has to do with responsibility and meaning, but its true significance appears hidden in precisely the same way that the wisdom dreams can bring forth is so often hidden. It is associated with the labyrinthine myth of the hero, he who speaks magic words, sees what others cannot or refuse to see, overcomes the giant, leads his people, slays the dragon, finds the treasure hard to attain, and rescues the virgin. These are all variants of the same perceptual and behavioral pattern, which is an outline of the universally adaptive pattern of being. The hero is also he who rescues his father from the belly of the beast. What could this idea, expressed so commonly in narrative form, possibly mean? Rescue your father, Osiris and Horus. Consider the ancient Egyptian story of Osiris, Set, Isis, and Horus. The Egyptians regarded Osiris as the founding deity of the state. You can profitably consider him to be an amalgam of all the personality characteristics of all the people who established the astonishing civilization on the Nile River. Osiris was worshipped as the culture-establishing hero whose world-creating exploits as a young, vibrant god produced one of the first great and enduring civilizations. But he aged, as all things do, and became willfully blind. The Egyptians insisted that this crucially important figure in their mythology possessed both of these attributes, and that insistence constituted a great truth. The great founder god became anachronistic, but, more importantly, he began to close his eyes when he knew full well he should have kept them open. Osiris stopped paying attention to how his kingdom was being run. That was willful blindness, and there is no blaming that on mere age. It is a terrible temptation, as it allows for the sequestration into the future the trouble we could face today. That would be fine if trouble did not compound like interest, but we all know that it does. Osiris's decision to close his eyes when he should have kept them open exacted a brutally heavy price: subjugation to his evil brother, Set. The idea that the state had a malevolent brother was an axiom, we might say, of the Egyptian worldview, no doubt the consequence of a complex, long-standing civilization observing its own flaws, and something that has retained its relevance to the current day. Once a properly functional hierarchy has been established, an opportunity opens for its positions of authority to be usurped, not by people who have the competence demanded by the task at hand, but by those willing to use manipulation, deceit, and compulsion to gain status and control. It was all those counterproductive forces that the Egyptians were attempting to conceptualize in the figure of Set, the enemy of illumination, enlightenment, vision, and consciousness. It was Set's greatest ambition to rule Egypt, to take the place of the rightful pharaoh. By turning a blind eye to his evil brother's machinations, by refusing to see, Osiris allowed Set to gain strength. This proved fatal, or as fatal as an error can be, to an immortal. Set bided his time until he caught Osiris in a moment of weakness. Then he dismembered him and scattered the pieces over the Egyptian countryside. It was not, is not, possible to finally kill Osiris, the eternal human impulse toward social organization. That is a force that will not die. But it is possible to break him into pieces, to make it difficult for him to get his act together, and that is exactly what Set managed. Osiris, god of order, falls apart. This happens all the time, in people's individual lives and equally in the history of families, cities, and states. Things fall apart when love affairs collapse, careers deteriorate, or cherished dreams die. When despair, anxiety, uncertainty, and hopelessness manifest themselves in the place of habitable order. And when nihilism and the abyss make their dread appearance, destroying the desirable and stable values of current life. Under such circumstances, chaos emerges. And that is why the goddess Isis, queen of the underworld and consort of Osiris, makes her appearance when Osiris is destroyed by Set. Isis scours the countryside, searching for the vital essence of Osiris. She finds it in the form of his dismembered phallus, vessel of the seminal idea, the spermatic word, the fructifying principle, and makes herself pregnant. What does this mean? The queen of the underworld, the goddess of chaos, is also the force that eternally renews. All the potential constrained by the previous system of apprehension, of category, of assumption, all the invisible limitation imposed upon the inhabitants of that orderly state, is released, for better and worse, when that system breaks into pieces. Thus, when the center will no longer hold, even at the darkest hour, new possibility makes itself manifest. It is for this reason that the archetypal hero is born when things are at their worst. The now pregnant Isis returns to her home in the underworld and gives birth in due time to Horus, rightful son of the long-lost king, alienated as he matures from his now corrupted kingdom, something we all experience during our maturation. His primary attribute is the eye, the famous Egyptian single eye, while his avatar is the falcon, a bird that takes precise aim at its prey, strikes the target with deadly accuracy, and possesses an acuity of vision unparalleled in the kingdom of living things. More importantly, however, Horus has the will to see, along with the ability. This is courage itself, the refusal to shrink from what makes itself known, no matter how terrible it seems. Horus is the great god of attention, and the Egyptians determined in their strange narrative manner, in a form of imaginative thinking that stretched over thousands of years, that the faculty of attention should rule over all others. Horus differs from Osiris, his father, in his willingness to see. He sees his uncle Set, for example, precisely for what he is. Set is pure malevolence, evil itself. Nonetheless, upon his maturity, Horus returns to the kingdom usurped from his father and confronts his uncle. They engage in an epic battle. The young god and rightful heir to the throne sees the opportunity lurking where responsibility has been abdicated and is unwilling to look away. This is no feat for the faint of heart, not when it is taken all the way to its logical conclusion, not when the corruption and the willful blindness is exposed all the way to the bottom. To look upon evil with eyes unshielded is dangerous beyond belief, regardless of how necessary it is to look. This is represented by Horus's initial partial defeat. During their confrontation, Set tears out one of his courageous nephew's eyes. Despite the damage he sustains, Horus emerges victorious. It is of vital importance to reiterate, in light of this victory, the fact that he enters the battle voluntarily. It is a maxim of clinical intervention, a consequence of observation of improvement in mental health across many schools of practical psychological thought, that voluntary confrontation with a feared, hated, or despised obstacle is curative. We become stronger by voluntarily facing what impedes our necessary progress. This does not mean bite off more than you can chew, any more than voluntarily enter battle means seek conflict carelessly. We are well advised to take on challenges at precisely the rate that engages and compels alertness and forces the development of courage, skill, and talent, and to avoid foolhardy confrontation with that which lies beyond current comprehension. How is it possible to gauge the rate at which challenges should be sought? It is the instinct for meaning, something far deeper and older than mere thought, that holds the answer. Does what you are attempting compel you forward, without being too frightening? Does it grip your interest, without crushing you? Does it eliminate the burden of time passing? Does it serve those you love, and perhaps even bring some good to your enemies? That is responsibility. Constrain evil. Reduce suffering. Confront the possibility that manifests in front of you every second of your life, with the desire to make things better, regardless of the burden you bear, regardless of life's often apparently arbitrary unfairness and cruelty. All other approaches merely deepen the pit, increase its heat, and doom those who inhabit it to continual worsening of their already serious problems. Everyone knows it. Everyone's conscience proclaims it. Everyone's true friend or loved one observes it and despairs when they see someone for whom they care failing to do what needs to be done. Horace takes his eye back from the defeated Set and banishes him beyond the borders of the kingdom. There's no killing Set. He is eternal as Osiris, eternal as Isis and Horus. The evil that threatens at all levels of experience is something or someone that everyone has to contend with always, psychologically and socially. But for a time, evil can be overcome, banished, and defeated. Then peace and harmony can prevail for as long as people do not forget what brought them both about. Horus recovers his eye. A sensible person in such a situation would thank his lucky stars, place his eye back into its empty socket, and get on with his life. But that is not what Horus does. He returns instead to the underworld, to the belly of the beast, to the kingdom of the dead, where he knows he will find the spirit of Osiris. Dismembered though he may be, near death, even dead in a sense, Osiris inhabits the underworld domain of chaos itself. That is the dead father in the belly of the beast. Horus finds the once great king and grants to him the eye torn out by Set. Once again, because of the sacrifice and vision of his son, the Ancient of Days can see. Horus then takes his father, vision restored, and returns with him to the kingdom so they can rule in tandem. The Egyptians insisted that it was this combination of vision, courage, and regenerated tradition that constituted the proper sovereign of the kingdom. It was this juxtaposition of wisdom and youth that comprised the essence of the power of the pharaoh, his immortal soul, the source of his authority. When you face a challenge, you grapple with the world and inform yourself. This makes you more than you are. It makes you increasingly into who you could be. Who could you be? You could be all that a man or woman might be. You could be the newest avatar in your own unique manner of the great ancestral heroes of the past. What is the upper limit to that? We do not know. Our religious structures hint at it. What would a human being who was completely turned on, so to speak, be like? How would someone who determined to take full responsibility for the tragedy and malevolence of the world manifest himself? The ultimate question of man is not who we are, but who we could be. When you peer into an abyss, you see a monster. If it is a small abyss, then it is a small monster. But if it is the ultimate abyss, then it is the ultimate monster. That is certainly a dragon, perhaps even the dragon of evil itself. The conceptualization of the monster in the abyss is the eternal predator lurking in the night, ready and able to devour its unsuspecting prey. That is an image that is tens of millions of years old, something coded as deeply in the recesses of our biological structure as anything conceptual can be coded. And it is not just the monsters of nature, but the tyrants of culture and the malevolence of individuals. It is all of that, with the latter dominant, terrible as that is to consider. And it is in the nature of mankind not to cower and freeze as helpless prey animals, nor to become a turncoat and serve evil itself, but to confront the lions in their lairs. That is the nature of our ancestors, immensely courageous hunters, defenders, shepherds, voyagers, inventors, warriors, and founders of cities and states. That is the father you could rescue, the ancestor you could become. And he is to be discovered in the deepest possible place, as that is where you must go if you wish to take full responsibility and become who you could be. And who might that be? Let us agree, to begin with, that you have a minimum moral obligation to take care of yourself. Maybe you are just selfishly interested in taking care of yourself. But then the questions arise, what do you mean by care? Which yourself are you talking about? We will just consider pure selfishness to begin with, uncontaminated self-interest. That keeps it simple. That means, for starters, that you are free to do anything you want, because you do not have to care about anyone else. But then something in you might well object. Wait just a moment. That will not work. Why not? Well, which self are you taking care of? Are you taking care of the you that specifically exists this minute? What will happen then in the next? Because the future is coming, as certainly for all intents and purposes, as the sun rises in the morning. And you are best advised to be ready for it. You know the risks if you choose to maximize now at the expense of later. Imagine that you are about to utter something thoughtless and angry. You think, take no prisoners, and say whatever comes to mind, no matter how unjust and cruel. You experience a release of positive emotion and enthusiasm along with that, as well as the satisfying venting of resentment. Immediately thereafter, however, you are in trouble, and that trouble might stick around for a very long time. You have clearly not acted in your best interests, even though you did just what you selfishly wanted to. And no one with any sense tells their beloved son or daughter, look, kid, just do exactly what feels good in the moment, and to hell with everything else. It does not matter. You do not say that, because you know full well that the future is coming for your child as surely as it comes for you. The mere fact that something makes you happy in the moment does not mean that it is in your best interest, everything considered. Life would be simple if that were the case. But there is the you now, and the you tomorrow, and the you next week, and next year, and in 5 years, and in a decade, and you are required by harsh necessity to take all of those yous into account. That is the curse associated with the human discovery of the future, and with it, the necessity of work. Because to work means to sacrifice the hypothetical delights of the present for the potential improvement of what lies ahead. Now, there is some utility in discounting the importance of the yous who exist far enough into the future, because the future is uncertain. It is not the case that you should be as concerned about the effects of your current actions 20 years down the road as you are now, because there is a very high probability that you are here right now, if you are listening to this, and somewhat less of a chance that you will be around then. And then there are the errors of prediction you will make when looking so far ahead. But the mounting uncertainty of distance in time does not stop sensible people from preparing for their later years. Here is what the future means. If you are going to take care of yourself, you are already burdened or privileged with a social responsibility. The you for whom you are caring is a community that exists across time. The necessity for considering this society of the individual, so to speak, is a burden and an opportunity that seems uniquely characteristic of human beings. Animals do not seem to consider the future in the same manner as we do. If you visit the African veldt and you observe a herd of zebras, you will often see lions lazing about around them. And as long as the lions are lying around relaxing, the zebras really do not mind. This attitude seems a little thoughtless from the human perspective. The zebras should instead be biding their time until the lions go to sleep. Then they should run off to a corner of the field in a herd and conspire a bit. And then several dozen of them should rush the sleeping lions and stomp them to death. That would be the end of the lion problem. But that is not what zebras do. They think, ah, look at those relaxed lions. Relaxed lions are never a problem. Zebras do not seem to have any real sense of time. They cannot conceptualize themselves across the temporal expanse. But human beings not only manage such conceptualization, they cannot shake it. We discovered the future some long time ago, and now the future is where we each live, in potential. We treat that as reality. It is a reality that only might be, but it is one with a high probability of becoming now, eventually, and we are driven to take that into account. You're stuck with yourself. You are burdened with who you are right now and who you are going to be in the future. That means that if you are treating yourself properly, you must consider your repetition across time. You are destined to play a game with yourself today that must not interfere with the game you play tomorrow, next month, next year, and so on. Thus, narrow selfishness is destined to be non-productive. It is for this reason, among others, that a strictly individualist ethic is a contradiction in terms. There is, in fact, little difference between how you should treat yourself once you realize that you are a community that extends across time, and how you should treat other people. In a marriage, for example, you face the same problem with your marital partner as you do with yourself. You are stuck with the consequences of an iterating game. You can treat your husband or wife any old way right now, this moment, no matter how horrid and thoughtless that way might be, but you are going to wake up with him or her tomorrow and next month and a decade from now, and if not that person, then someone else equally unfortunate. If you treat the person you are committed to in a manner that does not work when it is repeated across time, then you are playing a degenerating game, and you are both going to suffer terribly for it. This problem is not materially different from failing to make peace with your future self. The consequences are identical. Happiness and responsibility. People want to be happy, and no wonder. I have longed deeply many times for the return of happiness, hoping for its current presence, and I am certainly not alone in that. However, I do not believe you should pursue happiness. If you do so, you will run right into the iteration problem, because happy is a right now thing. If you place people in situations where they are feeling a lot of positive emotion, they get present focused and impulsive. This means make hay while the sun shines. Take your opportunities while things are good and act now. But now is by no means everything, and unfortunately, everything must be considered, at least insofar as you are able. In consequence, it is unlikely that whatever optimizes your life across time is happiness. I am not denying its desirability, by the way. If happiness comes to you, welcome it with gratitude and open arms. But be careful, because it does make you impetuous. What might serve as a more sophisticated alternative to happiness? Imagine it is living in accordance with the sense of responsibility, because that sets things right in the future. Imagine as well that you must act reliably, honestly, nobly, and in relationship to a higher good in order to manifest the sense of responsibility properly. The higher good would be the simultaneous optimization of your function and the function of the people around you, across time, as we have discussed previously. That is the highest good. Imagine that you make that aim conscious, that you articulate that aim as an explicit goal. Then a question arises. What is the consequence of that, psychologically? First, consider that most of the positive emotion people experience does not come from attaining something. There is the simple pleasure, more accurately, the satisfaction, that comes from having a good meal when hungry, and there is the more complex but similar satisfaction that is associated with accomplishing something difficult and worthwhile. Imagine, for example, that you graduate from grade 12. Graduation day marks the event. It is a celebration. But the next day, that is over, and you immediately face a new set of problems. Just as you are hungry again only a few hours after a satisfying meal. You are no longer king of the high school. You are bottom dog in the workforce or a freshman at a post-secondary institution. You are in the position of Sisyphus. You strove and struggled to push your boulder to the pinnacle, and you find yourself instead at the foot of the mountain. There is a near instantaneous transformation that comes as a consequence of attainment. Like impulsive pleasure, attainment will produce positive emotion. But also, like pleasure, attainment is unreliable. Another question thus emerges. What is a truly reliable source of positive emotion? The answer is that people experience positive emotion in relationship to the pursuit of a valuable goal. Imagine you have a goal. You aim at something. You develop a strategy in relationship to that aim, and then you implement it. And then, as you implement the strategy, you observe that it is working. That is what produces the most reliable positive emotion. Imagine over time that the attitudes and actions that manage this most effectively in a competition that is very Darwinian come eventually to dominate over all others. Imagine that is true psychologically and socially simultaneously. Imagine that this occurs in your own life, but also across the centuries as everyone interacts and talks and raises a particular mode of being to primary status. This implies something crucial. No happiness in the absence of responsibility. No valuable and valued goal. No positive emotion. You might object, well, what exactly constitutes a valid goal? Imagine that you are pursuing something pleasurable but short-term and trivial. The wise part of you will be comparing that pursuit to the possible goal of acting in the best interest of your community of future selves and your community of other people. Perhaps you are unwilling to allow yourself to realize that wisdom. You do not wish to bear the responsibility, not in place of an immediate impulsive focus on pleasure. You are fooling yourself, however, especially at the deeper levels of your being, if you believe such avoidance will prove successful. The wise and ancient parts of you, seriously concerned with your survival, are neither easy to deceive nor to set aside. But you take aim at a trivial goal anyway and develop a rather shallow strategy to attain it, only to find it is not satisfying because you do not care enough. It does not matter to you, not deeply. Furthermore, the fact that you are not pursuing the goal you should rightly be pursuing means that you are feeling guilty, ashamed, and lesser at the same time. This is not a helpful strategy. It is not going to work. I've never met anyone who was satisfied when they knew they were not doing everything they should be doing. We are temporally aware creatures. We know that we are continually and inescapably playing an iterated game from which we cannot easily hide. No matter how much we wish to discount the future completely, it is part of the price we paid for being acutely self-conscious and able to conceptualize ourselves across the entire span of our lives. We are stuck with it. There is no escaping from the future, and when you are stuck with something and there is no escaping from it, the right attitude is to turn around voluntarily and confront it. That works. And so, instead of your short-term impulsive goal, you lay out a much larger scale goal, which is to act properly in relationship to the long term for everyone. Pick up the extra weight. There is a proper way to behave, an ethic, and you are destined to contend with it. You cannot help but calculate yourself across time and everyone else across time, and you are reporting back to yourself inevitably on your own behavior and misbehavior. What works across multiple time frames and multiple places for multiple people, including yourself, that is the goal. It is an emergent ethic, hard to formulate explicitly, but inescapable in its existence and its consequences, and an ineradicably deep part of the game of being. Great players are attractive. Attractive people attract mates. The closer we match the pattern, the emergent pattern, the more likely we are to survive and protect our families. The playing field selects the players on the basis of their ethical behavior, and we are therefore biologically prepared to respond positively to and to imitate the great player, and to disapprove even violently of the deceiver, the cheat, and the fraud. And it is your conscience, your instinct for moral virtue, that indicates deviation from the path. When your child purposefully trips an opponent during a soccer game or fails to pass to an open teammate with a great opportunity to score, you frown. You feel shame, as you should, because you are witnessing the betrayal of someone you love by someone you love, and that is your child's self-betrayal. Something similar occurs when you violate your own sense of propriety. It is the same instinct, and it is best attended to. If you do not follow the right path, you will wander off a cliff and suffer miserably. And there is simply no way that the most profound parts of yourself are going to allow that without protest. You might rationalize. There is no cliff here now. There is no cliff I can see nearby. And a cliff I will not tumble off for 10 years is a long way away. But the part of your psyche that is most profound invariably objects. Such thinking is not appropriate. It will not do. What is 10 years away is still real, despite its distance, allowing for unavoidable errors of prediction. If there is a catastrophe waiting there, we are not going to aim at it now, not without objection. If your behavior suggests that you are tilting in that direction, then you are going to feel guilty and horrible about it if you are lucky and even minimally awake. And thank God for that. If the cost of betraying yourself in the deepest sense is guilt, shame, and anxiety, the benefit of not betraying yourself is meaning, the meaning that sustains. That is the most valuable of opportunities that lurks where responsibility has been abdicated. If you attend to your conscience, you will begin to determine that some of the things you are doing are wrong. More precisely, if you are alerted to the possibility of your own wrongdoing by your conscience, and you then begin to engage in a true dialogue with that same agent, you will begin to develop a clear picture of what is wrong, and, by implication, of what is right. Right is not least the opposite of wrong, and wrong is in some clear sense more blatant and obvious. A sense of right can therefore be developed and honed through careful attention to what is wrong. You act and betray yourself, and you feel bad about that. You do not know exactly why. You try to avoid thinking about it because it is less painful and easier in the short term not to think about it. You try with all your might to ignore it, but all that does is increase your sense of self-betrayal and further divide you against yourself. So, you reconsider, perhaps, and you confront your discomfort. You note your disunity and the chaos that comes with it. You ask yourself. You pray to discover what you did wrong. And the answer arrives, and it is not what you want. And part of you must therefore die so that you can change, and the part that must die struggles for its existence, puts forward its rationale, and pleads its case. And it will do so with every trick in its possession, employing the most egregious lies, the bitterest, most resentment-eliciting memories of the past, and the most hopelessly cynical attitudes about the future, indeed, about the value of life itself. But you persevere and discriminate, judge, and decide exactly why what you did was wrong, and you start to understand, by contrast, what might have been right. And then you determine to start acting in accordance with your conscience. You decide that it is a partner, despite its adversarial form. You put all that you have discovered to be right into action, and you begin your ascent. You start to monitor yourself, ever more careful to ensure you are doing the right thing. Listening to what you say, watching yourself act, trying not to deviate from the straight and narrow path. That becomes your goal. An idea begins to take shape. I am going to live my life properly. I am going to aim at the good. I am going to aim at the highest good I can possibly manage. Now, all the parts of you taking care of your future self are on board. You are all aimed in one direction. You are no longer a house divided against itself. You are standing solidly on a firm foundation. You are no longer so easy to dissuade or discourage. Your resolution trumps your nihilism and despair. The struggle you have had with your own tendency to doubt and dissimulate protects you against the unwarranted and cynical criticisms of others. There's a high goal, a mountain peak, a star that shines in the darkness, beckoning above the horizon. Its mere existence gives you hope. And that is the meaning without which you cannot live. Remember Pinocchio? When Geppetto wants to transform the wooden-headed puppet he created into something real, he first raises his eyes above the horizon and wishes on a star. It is the same star that announces Pinocchio's birth at the beginning of the movie and whose light is reflected in the golden badge granted to Jiminy Cricket at the close. It is the same star, symbolically speaking, that announces the birth of Christ in the depths of the darkness. Geppetto focuses on the star and makes a wish. The wish is that his marionette with strings controlled by someone or something else will become real. The story of the puppet and his temptations and trials is a psychological drama. We all understand it, although we cannot necessarily articulate that understanding. It is necessary to lift your eyes above the horizon to establish a transcendent goal if you wish to cease being a puppet under the control of things you do not understand and perhaps do not want to understand. Then all the subsystems or subpersonalities that might otherwise be pursuing their own limited fulfillment will join together under the aegis of the truly ideal, and the consequence of that will be an engagement that approximates the ultimate or total. Under such conditions, all the parts of you are going to be on board. That is the psychological equivalent of monotheism. That is the emergence of the higher self that might be the true servant of God in whatever metaphysical reality potentially underlies what is obvious to our blind and limited mortal selves. What is the antidote to the suffering and malevolence of life? The highest possible goal. What is the prerequisite to pursuit of the highest possible goal? Willingness to adopt the maximum degree of responsibility. And this includes the responsibilities that others disregard or neglect. You might object, why should I shoulder all that burden? It is nothing but sacrifice, hardship, and trouble. But what makes you so sure you do not want something heavy to carry? You positively need to be occupied with something weighty, deep, profound, and difficult. Then, when you wake up in the middle of the night and the doubts crowd in, you have some defense. For all my flaws, which are manifold, at least I am doing this. At least I am taking care of myself. At least I am of use to my family and to the other people around me. At least I am moving, stumbling upward under the load I have determined to carry. You can attain some genuine self-respect that way, but it is not a mere shallow psychological construct that has to do with how you are construing yourself in the moment. It is far deeper than that, and it is not only psychological. It is real as well as psychological. Your life becomes meaningful in precise proportion to the depths of the responsibility you are willing to shoulder. That is because you are now genuinely involved in making things better. You are minimizing the unnecessary suffering. You are encouraging those around you by example and word. You are constraining the malevolence in your own heart and the hearts of others. A bricklayer may question the utility of laying his bricks monotonously, one after another. But perhaps he is not merely laying bricks. Maybe he is building a wall, and the wall is part of a building, and the building is a cathedral. And the purpose of the cathedral is the glorification of the highest good. And under such circumstances, every brick laid is an act that partakes of the divine. And if what you are doing in your day-to-day activity is not enough, then you are not aiming at the construction of a proper cathedral. And that is because you are not aiming high enough. Because if you were, then you would experience the sense of meaning in relationship to your sufficiently high goal, and it would justify the misery and limitations of your life. If you have something meaningful to pursue, then you are engrossed in life. You are on a meaningful path. The most profound and reliable instinct for meaning, if not perverted by self-deceit and sin, there is no other way to state it, manifests itself when you are on the path of maximum virtue. A sense of meaning is an indicator that you are on that path. It is an indication that all the complexity that composes you is lined up within you and aimed at something worth pursuing, something that balances the world, something that produces harmony. It is something you hear made manifest in music and the profound sense of meaning that music intrinsically produces. Maybe you are a nihilistic death metal punk. You are deeply skeptical and pessimistic. You find meaning nowhere. You hate everything just on principle. But then your favorite nihilistic death metal punk band lead guitarist and his bandmates start to blast out their patterned harmonies, each in alignment with the other, and you are caught. Ah! I do not believe in anything, but God, that music. And the lyrics are destructive and nihilistic and cynical and bitter and hopeless, but it does not matter because the music beckons and calls to your spirit and fills it with the intimation of meaning and moves you so that you align yourself with the patterns and you nod your head and tap your feet to the beat, participating despite yourself. It is those patterns of sound, layered one on top of another, harmoniously, moving in the same direction, predictably and unpredictably, in perfect balance, order and chaos in their eternal dance. And you dance with it, no matter how scornful you are. You align yourself with that patterned, directional harmony. and in that you find the meaning that sustains. You are possessed of an instinct, a spirit, that orients you toward the highest good. It calls your soul away from hell and toward heaven. And because it is there, you find yourself frequently disillusioned. People disappoint you. You betray yourself. You lose a meaningful connection to your workplace, boss, or partner. You think, "The world is not set right. It is deeply troubling to me." That very disenchantment, however, can serve as the indicator of destiny. It speaks of abdicated responsibility, of things left undone, of things that still need to be done. You are irritated about that need. You are annoyed with the government. You are embittered and resentful about your job. You are unhappy with your parents, and you are frustrated with all those people around you who will not take on responsibility. There are, after all, things that are crying out to be accomplished. You are outraged that what needs to be done is not being done. That anger, that outrage, is, however, a doorway. That observation of abdicated responsibility is the indication of destiny and meaning. The part of you that is oriented towards the highest good is pointing out the disjunction between the ideal you can imagine, the ideal that is possessing you, and the reality you are experiencing. There's a gap there, and it is communicating its need to be filled. You can give way to fury and consequence and blame it on someone else, and it is not as if other people are not contributing to the problems. Or you can come to understand that your very disappointment is an indication to you from the most fundamental levels of your being that there is something wrong that needs to be set right, and perhaps by you. What is it, that concern, that care, that irritation, that distraction? It is not the call to happiness. It is the call to the action and adventure that make up a real life. Consider once again the biblical story of Abraham. God comes to Abraham and says, "Go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." Genesis 12:1-3. That late bloomer Abraham has been hanging around his father's tent for far too many years, to put it mildly. But if God's call comes, it is better to heed it, no matter how late, and in that there is real hope for those who believe that they have delayed too long. Abraham leaves his country and his people and his father's household and journeys out into the world, following the still small voice, following God's call. And it is no call to happiness. It is the complete bloody catastrophe we previously described: famine, war, and domestic strife. All this might make the reasonable individual, not to mention Abraham himself, doubt the wisdom of listening to God and conscience and of adopting the responsibility of autonomy and the burden of adventure. Better to be lying in a hammock, devouring peeled grapes in the security of Dad's tent. What calls you out into the world, however, to your destiny, is not ease. It is struggle and strife. It is bitter contention and the deadly play of the opposites. It is probable, inevitable, that the adventure of your life will frustrate and disappoint and unsettle you as you heed the call of conscience and shoulder your responsibility and endeavor to set yourself and the world right. But that is where the deep meaning that orients you and shelters you is to be found. That is where things will line up for you, where things that have been scattered apart and broken will come together, where purpose will manifest itself, where what is proper and good will be supported, and what is weak and resentful and arrogant and destructive will be defeated. That is where the life that is worth living is to be eternally found, and where you can find it, personally, if only you are willing. Notice that opportunity lurks where responsibility has been abdicated.